1900 or 1899, in the fall of 1899, there came to our school district a young girl. She probably wasn't over 18 years old, because by that time they had passed a law that said that a person who wanted to get a teacher's certificate had to be at least 18. Up until 1893, it was for a few years there had been a law after 1893 that fixed the age of an applicant for a teacher's certificate at 17. Before that, there was no age limit. A girl 15 years old, at least back in the days when they had school inspectors who gave the examinations, a girl 15 years old could take one of those examinations and be given a teacher's certificate. And this girl, 15 years old, the examinations were very simple. A friend of mine who helped me on getting some of the material that I put, he gave me a letter from who was written by his aunt. And they came to Michigan about in the early days of Michigan history, and when she went before a board of school examiners, he'd ask her one question about a subject. For instance, what's the capital of the United States? Why, Washington. And that would be the question on history. And what's the longest river in the United States? That would be a question on geography or something like that. And that would make a satisfactory, if she could answer them, that would be a satisfactory examination. And she could get a teacher's certificate and be hired as a teacher in a district school at that time. So when they, in 1893, they fixed the age at 18 years. Well, then, in 1899, a young girl out of probably who had never been beyond the 10th grade in a school, but she was a very pleasant little girl, and she brought in to our school a personality that influenced me a great deal. She encouraged me to take the 8th grade examination. Until she came there, I didn't even know there was such a thing as an 8th grade examination. And while I didn't do too well on that 8th grade examination, I did well enough so that in the fall of 1900, I was permitted to go to the Davison High School, which was a school in 1900 of 10 grades, though they added in 11th grade while I was still there. Now, high schools in those days were very, in a way, rather simple. In a school in a village like Davison, there were only 5 teachers in the whole school, from the first grade up through the 10th. And the high school, the man at the head of it, he was called a superintendent. And we happened to have in that school one of these old-fashioned school teachers who was a very good disciplinarian and who made you get your lessons. And we had a review class in certain subjects that he knew that we hadn't gotten very well in a country school. For instance, he gave us a review in mental arithmetic, and he made us know our combinations and our multiplication tables, and he would make us analyze every question, every problem that we worked. And he made us work, say out in words like this: if one bushel of wheat is worth 79 cents, 8 bushels would be worth 8 times 79 cents. And the farmer would get so much for 8 bushels of wheat. Things like that. And so that you not only had to learn to multiply and divide orally, but you had to understand exactly what you were doing. And I think probably in that about 3 months that he gave that course, I got more arithmetic than I had in all this work that I had ever done in arithmetic before that. Now, when we got, you see, then in the next 10th grade, they got another teacher when I was in the 10th grade, and then, so that they had 2 teachers in the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grades. But when I finished the 11th grade, there were only 8 of us in the class that finished the 11th grade in that school. And my people, my father and mother, father had been a Civil War veteran, and he'd never been very strong. During the Civil War, he had everything of all the diseases that they ever had, and he served nearly 4 years. So when he was sick, he farmed over to my next older brother, and they moved to Davison so that I could go to high school. And then when I got through in 11th grade in Davison, we had to move to Flint, which was 15 miles from the farm where I was born. And when I came to Flint with my credits, they would only give me 10.5 years of credit for the work that I had done in the little village school. So I had to take 2 years of extra work in Flint, but that second year in Flint probably was the best year in high school that I ever had. And Flint then was considered one of the best schools in, that is, in one of as good as any school in Michigan. And that would be in, and I graduated from the Flint High School in 1905. Michigan Education Society was organized in 1853 in Ypsilanti. It seems that they had called the teachers together in Ypsilanti to, at the dedication of the Normal College. And at that Normal College, they organized the Michigan Educational Association. Now, that association had then, of course, had a president and a vice president and a secretary and a treasurer. And then they provided that each teacher would pay, they would have teacher's institutes under the supervision of this Michigan Educational Association. And once a year, they would have an annual meeting. Now, when these annual meetings would be held in some place where as many teachers as possible. Of course, at first, probably only the high school people in the villages, but gradually it extended so that the rural school teachers were becoming parts of the MEA. Because when I became school commissioner, they had what they called a rural section of the MEA. And this MEA was one of the organizations that probably had a great deal to do. At first, of course, they didn't do so much, but it was through their influence that the kindergarten work started in Michigan, such things as the kindergarten. And then back in sometime, one of the main things at first that it did, the men who were, they had a superintendent section, and at their meetings, they would discuss the things that they thought ought to be done in the schools. And if there was, that's how they got the kindergarten started. That is, they would, one school would say, we're planning to start a kindergarten this year, next year somebody else would do it. It came through the influence of the MEA. Then they would recommend changes. For instance, they would recommend township unit laws, but they could, that was one thing they never could get through. That they did finally, though, there was one bill for a township unit, and it was an optional bill passed about 1891, and that was about the time that the Upper Peninsula counties were being organized. And most of the Upper Peninsula was organized under a township unit instead of districts. So they always, and I remember when I was teaching and I'd attend these MEA meetings, the men from the Upper Peninsula would do a little bragging about their, yeah, they were in the mining district and they had more money than the average school district, and they were having better school buildings built up there, and they claimed they had better schools because they had more money and a lower tax rate because the mines were paying much of the bill. Then they did such things as, for instance, the athletic associations that we were organized in the high school. They were the instruments. The high school superintendents would begin talking about it, and then they made the Michigan Athletic Association. And they would have branches. That is what I mean by that. They'd have Grand Rapids teachers would have a meeting of their own, and it was in one of the meetings, branch meetings, when someone suggested teacher pensions and things like that came through the work of the Michigan Education Association. And that is their main object for years, was for better teaching, better programs. The Athletic Association was organized, the teacher pension plan was brought up and gotten through the legislature by the MEA, and they did a good many things like that to better teaching conditions and make the schools better in the state. It has always been a subject or a body of people who work for better schools. Unfortunately, they had a division. One section of the Michigan Education Association left the regular association, became affiliated American Federation of Labor, and it became just a labor organization. That's about all you can say. Well, then when they got to, and that's today, that's about all the thing is. It's just it has degenerated, in my opinion, into a labor organization. There are two sections of it yet. The Michigan Education, the old Michigan Education Association still exists, but they were forced to become a bargaining agent in this school situation. And that's why that you've got, there's one school in Michigan, I guess, still just, or just settled there. Been without teachers here for 4 weeks. Which to me is, that is, that shouldn't be allowed. They can have their organizations, but I don't think they should be allowed. And I think under the state, if they had officers with a little bit more courage, they wouldn't let them, they'd make them get together and settle their disputes. Why those children should have to suffer, because, of course, if you want to get down to the final, the big thing in Michigan has to be a difference in financing the schools. Now, I can take you back, in 1851, they passed a law that levied a one mill tax, and I guess it was 1848, one mill tax on all of the property in a district. Then that was raised to two mills. And that money, when it was first levied, was to be divided in the township according to the number of children in a district. But about 1887, there probably were a lot of districts where the one mill or the two mills it got to be, raised more money in the district than they needed to pay their teachers, because they had a lot of wealth but not many children. So they had enough influence, those people, in the legislature that they reduced that to one mill. And then they went on a little further in a year or two later and said that that money in a township should be not distributed according to the number of children, but should be distributed according to the district where it was raised. That is, if a district had a lot of wealth and few children, well, that district would get the most of the money. And that began in the great evil that still exists. Poor districts with high tax rates, rich districts with low tax rates. And that's why at this time, now the Michigan Education Association, I think, have been back this petition drive to get on the Constitution this fall, on an amendment to the Constitution that will outlaw the levying of money to get the main part of the money to run a school from the district taxes and put it on an income tax. Now that's why that probably I'll vote for that law, because it doesn't matter too much whether it's a graduated income or a straight income. It's going to be an income tax, and the man will pay according to his income and not according to his property. If he's got no children and quite a little property, under the present law, if he happens to live in a poor district, he's almost taxed out of existence. The tax rates, when even as back as far ago as when I was in school, and I've noticed it since. I could give you one example. There's a street that separates two districts in Wayne County. On the north side of the street is Warren Township, where all the Chrysler plants are located. Probably a few dollars a thousand will take care of their school taxes. Cross the street, there are no factories, nothing but small houses and small business plants. It's always been a high-taxed district. That is, in Warren Township, a few dollars a thousand gives them good schools. Across the street is a Madison Township or Madison School District, for instance, with a lot of children and no property. And that's the big thing that must be remedied in Michigan, to give the children, all of the children, an equal opportunity. Now, before before this was issued, the governor wanted to consolidate the districts. Well, that still should be done. We don't need 600 school districts in Michigan. For some reason, that idea that you have to live in a district to know the school officers, that's probably all right. But today, nobody has any real influence, no matter how much. You don't have anything to say of how your money is going to be spent in a school district. You're just going to pay that money regardless. And if your school district is wasting the money because you're a little district with a lot of officers and a lot of expense, now, what should be done? We should reduce the school districts in Michigan to, say, 100, maybe 150. That would be getting rid of about 450 school districts. Now, maybe this wouldn't work, but I think it would. We go to Florida every winter, and I've done business in Florida for years because our material that we make down at our shop is good in Florida or California. And Florida has 67 counties. They have 67 school districts. We have 83 counties and about 600 school districts, counting the intermediate school districts. Now, people look down their nose at the people in Florida, but they have just as good schools paying just as good wages as we are in Michigan. Their schools are just as good. Their requirements for teachers are just as high as ours. And they have good schools as we have. But they only have 67 school districts. Now, we're wasting a lot of money on this excessive organization. In Genesee County, since we have 22 school districts, 18 townships, 14 villages and cities, and a county government are a total of 55 governments in the county. If you go down to Florida, and you can go in several other places, I think there's Indianapolis has got to be that way, and Cuyahoga County in Ohio. You go into 2 years or 3 years ago, the Duval County in Ohio, they had only one district as for schools. They combined all of the cities in Duval County. They never had any townships. They always had a lot of little cities. They combined into one county government for all of the municipal affairs, and they have one school government for all the school. Now, Duval County is where Jacksonville is, and together with the county, they have around 700,000 people. Now, compared with Genesee County, with around 400,000 people and 55 municipal or kind of governments, 55 separate governments, they have two separate governments. Now, maybe they aren't as efficient, but I just imagine that they're just as efficient as we are. Because last spring, the man in Duval County who had opposed this ran for mayor of the new city against the man who favored it 3 years ago when they organized it, and he beat the man who was opposed to it almost 2-1 because the people and have come to the conclusion that they don't need so much government. They just need government, but not a surplus of government. When I first came to Flint, Flint was just a horse and buggy town, just like any other town in Michigan. Flint was then the center of the buggy work manufacturing. The more buggies were made in Flint than any other place in the United States. They were made by a firm named Durant and Dort. Durant had been, his grandfather had been governor of Michigan during the Civil War. His grandfather's name was Crapo. We have a Crapo Street here in Flint. And for years they had a big farm out here west of Flint called the Crapo Farm. But anyway, his mother had married a man named Durant, and they lived down near Boston. Well, this young Durant came to Flint in 1881 or 1882 and was clerking in a store on Saginaw Street. And one day he was standing in the door looking out on the street, which was then nothing but a dirt road through the middle of the city. And he saw a man go by with a one-horse cart, and it was different than any cart he'd ever seen before. And it kind of struck that young fella as something maybe he might be interested in. And so he ran out and stopped the man and found out that cart had been made in Coldwater, Michigan. And the next day he got on the train and probably had to change cars 2 or 3 times to get to Coldwater, and bought the patent for that cart. Then he came back to Flint and got a man named Dort interested with him, and they had a man named Patterson who had been making a few buggies. Patterson had a blacksmith shop and had added to it a little buggy shop, and they got him to make that cart. And he made them, as I remember, for $4 a piece, and Durant sold them for $7 a piece. And he sold them so fast that Patterson couldn't make them fast enough, so he and Dort went into the cart-making business, started a factory of their own. And then they graduated carts, they went into making buggies. And they made what they called the Blue Ribbon Buggies. And in 1903, Flint made more buggies, probably, than any other state.